This is the Life Truth Network.
Quest for our Truth, Episode 346.
Quest for Truth, presented by Protectorate Productions and HPN, Helsley Podcast Network. Now located at life-truth.com. And now, here is your host, Keith Helsley. Solving all your problems and making your dreams come true. I think I might shoot myself.
Hey everyone, this is your host Keith. Welcome to Quest for Truth, where we try to compare worldviews and examine truth topics, whether it's inside the Bible or outside the Bible. Today we're going to be talking about the Bible. So there's that. It's going to be part two of the episode I did 2 weeks ago called The King James as the Gold Standard. And it came up because of that question, what makes it the gold standard? And, of course, we got an interview in between, and we may have another one coming up. I haven't got it scheduled yet, so I don't know how soon exactly. But anyway, anticipate that. Sit on the edge of your seats and wait. Anyway. So let's get started here. In my previous episode, we talked about how the Bible came to be, and how the manuscripts were maintained, and how we arrived at the first English translations, starting at Wycliffe, which is actually technically is Middle English, so it doesn't really count in our modern thinking of English. It wasn't until Tyndale, who only did the New Testament, followed by, I think it was Thomas Matthew, who took Tyndale's work and included an updated Old Testament, because the Septuagint Old Testament was a little bit empty in spots, we'll say. And then that led to, what was next? Cloverdale was the next one. First, King Henry hated it, then he liked it, had it spit polished up a little bit, called it the Great Bible, I think. And then that was followed by another change of command in the Bishop's Bible, which was simultaneous with the Geneva Bible. One bishop's, of course, being Catholic, and Geneva being the Reformers. And that's where we ended at. And that was had commented, then you'll hear me comment in a few moments as I pick up on our main topic, that the one thing that set the Geneva Bible apart was it used the Roman-style lettering that we use today. It was much easier for the English eyes to read and understand, not the old Gothic form letters, the Germanic-looking things. And that's what set it apart. It was wildly popular. And, well, I'll just leave it there, because I'll pick up with that thought as we continue on with why the King James is the gold standard. So, right after a word from our Christian podcast community, we'll get started with our main topic. And you can find a lot of other great shows. Some new ones are being added all the time there at ChristianPodcastCommunity.org. Voices like these.
Hey everybody, Joel and Troy here with Revived Thoughts, and we're excited to introduce a new show that we call Revived Devos.
Just like Revived Thoughts takes sermons from the past and allows you to hear them again, the goal of Revived Devos is to bring devotionals from great speakers and great men of God of the past and allow you to hear their thoughts, their ideas, their encouragement for you again on a daily basis. Every single day we will be releasing at least one episode of Revived Devos, and you'll be able to hear back from men like Andrew Murray, Jonathan Edwards, Martin Luther, and several others, and you'll get the chance to focus on God. It's only 2 to 3 minutes long, and we think it would be a really great addition to any morning routine.
You can find it by searching Revive Devos in your podcast app of choice.
Hey, I'm Daryl, and I'm here with my wife, Karen.
What's up?
And we're the hosts of the What Are We Even Doing Here podcast, the podcast that seeks to answer the question that we've all asked, what are we even doing here? We cover topics such as marriage, family, life, and living a Christian life in this crazy world. We don't have all the answers, but we know where to look.
Subscribe to us on iTunes and follow us on SoundCloud as we seek the kingdom of God and find out what we are even doing here.
Grace and peace.
All right, main topic.
Main topic.
All right, the hallmark of the Geneva Bible is its typeface. It used a Roman alphabet lettering, which was extremely easy to read for English-speaking people, and not the Gothic German-looking scrolly stylized letters. That was really, besides being an accurate translation and all the notes, the study notes and commentary and explanatory notes, it made it really a milestone, and it was extremely wildly popular with Protestants. Now, there is a Douay Rheims Bible that the Catholics wanted to, or they wanted, they produced during this time frame. Douay Rheims is the two cities where it was based out of. The problem with it is that its intention was to be like the Geneva had study notes that catered to Protestant. It had such heavily notated study notes, but it was more catered towards Catholic religious features, and it made it not all that accurate as far as the translation goes. I don't know, maybe, but the notes really made it biased. Now, the notes in the Geneva, I would say, are probably not so much biased. I mean, John Calvin had a big hand in it, as did other big names of the time. Now, it was perceived by King James to be biased against the, not so much the Catholic Church, but biased against having it kingship. Now, you have to remember that the Geneva Bible was put together around 1560. They went through some updates. I think some of the final revisions taking place around 1590s. And so it was in existence for a good 40, 50 years before the King James Bible was published. Or actually about 40 years before King James says, I don't like this. Because it was about 1603 or 8, somewhere in there, King James says, I don't like this wildly popular, insanely popular Bible that all you Protestants are reading. It is the most, like wildfire. Everybody had it. All the churches, even the churches where the bishop's Bible was proclaimed to be the only one read from the pulpit, they might have it there, but there's records, sermon notes and whatnot, that they often would preach out of the Geneva Bible. It was, the big thing. But the big thing that King James did not like is the Geneva Bible. It had comments that were geared towards the king wouldn't have any power if it wasn't for God putting him in power, which is true of any government. And there was other similar comments that he felt could lead to encouraging people to overthrow the government, because if it was a lousy government, you get your authority from God, and the people do, and not really so much from the government. It kind of reminds me of our current constitution in this country. We the people, the government gets its authority from the people, not the people don't get their freedom from the government. And King James did not like those kind of ideas being published there in the margin notes in the Bible. And so he commissioned a team of approximately 50, I think it was 47 translators, to come up with a good translation. The translators were both Anglican and Puritan. They used the best of the original languages. They worked in, I think it was two-man teams. They broke it down into six teams, something like that. So it was, and but anyway, each team translated a portion of the Bible. And they went, so by the time it was done, you had, they translate a portion of the Bible, and then they would pass it around. Each team then could review, like a peer review of the other team's work. So if team one did it, and they passed it off to team two, or three, and four, and five, they each had a chance to peer review it. And, of course, team one got the chance to review the work from the other teams. So by the time it's done, it had gone through, you know, maybe 13 different revisions to tighten up the translation, to tweak it here, tweak it there, and to make it as accurate as possible. That's one of its, okay, you talk about gold standards. This is a gold standard mark here, is that it had a fairly large team of people working on it, 47 people. And they not only, I'm going to do it isolated from you guys, they translate it and let their colleagues challenge what they did, update it if they thought it wasn't accurate. And that is probably the single biggest hallmark of why the King James became the gold standard. King James had a list of 15 rules that his translators were to follow. I don't think I have it handy here. Let's see. Nope. I'm going to have to find my other file here. Okay. Instructions to the translators. For the better ordering of the proceedings of the translators, His Majesty recommends the following rules to be carefully observed. Number one, they were to use the bishop's Bible and to stick to that as much as the original languages would permit. So the King James Bible wasn't a flat-out blank page, let's take the Greek and Hebrew and come up with something new. No, it actually stood on the shoulders of the bishop's Bible, which stood on the shoulders of the Great Bible, which stood on the shoulders of Tyndale and Wycliffe. So it's a culmination of all the great translators who went on before. But it was to start with the bishop's Bible and basically use the language to tweak it, make sure it was tight. The names of prophets and the holy writers were to be retained as near as possible as far as they were commonly used. The old ecclesiastical work was to be used, they would use the word church, not congregation or gathering, when you talk about ecclesia. So anytime you see the word church, a lot of people don't like that in modern times because the original word was ecclesia, and it actually is more accurate as a gathering or something like that. So King James, he did that. Now, for better or worse, there's a milestone for you. When any word has diverse translations, it is to be used by the most common word by previous translators. In other words, if you have a word that can mean wildly different things, to use the one that is most commonly put in use. You don't want to rock the boat and use something crazy. Go for the middle of the road. Go for the conservative word choice. Don't make something wildly weird. They were to keep the chapter divisions the same, and make little changes possible, but they can make changes if they wanted to. And there are times when the King James moved a couple verses out of one chapter into the next. And there are times, come on, one more time. And there are times when the King James did move a verse or two in and out of a chapter. And honestly, there's a couple times where it makes you scratch your head and say, "But why? What were you thinking of? It doesn't belong there, clearly." And the word on chapters and verses, Geneva Bible was the first one to use verse designations. Before that, chapter divisions were in wide use, and I think a lot of the Old Testament chapters are based on how the Jews had them chopped up in Biblical Hebraica. But I think going back to the Rasmussen parallel Greek and Latin Vulgate, I think chapter divisions go back as far as that. I'd have to check my other notes on that. I don't have handy. There was to be no marginal notes, except for maybe the rare translation of a Greek or Hebrew word, which you can't otherwise derive the meaning out of the context. So, and there are a couple of marginal notes in King James, but it's nothing to compare with the notes you would find in the Geneva Bible. Let's see. I don't understand what this means, but such quotations of places marginally set down shall be set for the fit representation of one verse to another. I don't know what that means. Such quotations of places to be marginally set down as shall serve for the fit references of one scripture to another. I get it now. What that statement number 7 there means is whenever the scripture quotes from another place, the quotation should match, basically. Number 8, each man of each company to take the same chapter or chapters, amend them by himself as he fits good, and together, and whatever the group agrees on shall stand. That's kind of munched that a little bit. But that's what I was saying earlier, is each team did their own work, and they had a chance to peer review the other's team work. Any one company, after completing a book, they would pass this around to their peer review before submitting it to the king. If any of the company shall differ, they had to have a general meeting. And again, they had a chance to peer review each other's work and hash it out, iron it out. When there's any obscurity that is in doubt, letters are to be sent out for other, basically, scholars in the land for their input. So if there's anything that these translators doubted, and if they knew somebody who knew this area, they were allowed to call on a special expert. And letters were to be sent to bishops and clergy of the churches to review their work. So this is very, very widely peer reviewed. Number 13, the directors of each company basically drew on all the experts of Cambridge and Oxford universities. Number 14, these translations, when they didn't agree with the bishop's Bible,
they could draw on the previous English versions, such as Tyndale, Coverdale, Matthews, Geneva, and so forth. So they were allowed to draw on the work of all the other English translators. And finally, 15, the directors of the teams could call upon, of course, universities and basically all the top-level, top-tier educators, scholars, learned people of the land. So it was peer-reviewed by team by team, chapter by chapter, book by book. And if there's rust spots, there was a lot of leeway for calling on outside sources. Now, the question I have here is, certainly things like, well, Tyndale did his work alone. He had to do it alone. Now, he did have students, because he was a teacher. He did have students help out. And when it comes to the Coverdale and others, I kind of zoomed through fast, but they also had teams and other scholarly foundation to draw upon. All the way through each one, it wasn't like Tyndale doing it alone, or Thomas Matthew doing it alone. Now, King James actually had these 15 points to really outline and hammer the levels of peer review that were to take place. Now, if you want to say why the King James is the gold standard, that right there, I think, knocks it out of the park, is the attention to peer review. It did not discount earlier versions like the Geneva or Tyndale or others. It actually used them. And in fact, a lot of the New Testament is heavily drawn on Tyndale's work and other things plugged into it. If you want to say it's the oldest, you're wrong. If you want to say it's the first authorized, you'd be wrong. If you want to say, the first to use Greek and Hebrew as opposed to Latin, you'd be wrong. This right here, it's peer review. It's honestly what makes it the gold standard. It's not custom, it's not tradition, it's not spelling, it's not grammar. Trust me, there are people who say, oh my gosh, they put a lowercase s for spirit instead of an uppercase s for spirit. Oh my gosh, they use quotation marks. The KJV doesn't use quotation marks, well, that's true. But you're talking about punctuation. One thing when you want to split hairs about spelling or uppercase or punctuation, you have to remember this. The English language from the time of Wycliffe in the 1300s, Middle English, to King James 1611, Modern English, is a span of 300 years. A lot of change has happened in 300 years. The language went through a lot of changes. The alphabet, even at 1611, was still being formed. They didn't use the same letters we have today. The spelling was different. They actually used punctuation different. In fact, we use a period to end a sentence. You know what they would use to end a sentence? A double dash. They would use a period sometimes. But they often use the double dash to serve as a period. That's how they set their sentences off. They didn't use quotation marks, true, but they still set off their quotation. You could still tell, Jesus said, and then what followed, there would be some kind of indication, maybe not an actual quotation mark, but you could tell what came next. And so the use of punctuation marks, in fact, they weren't widely, they were almost never used. They existed, but they were almost never used before Gutenberg and the printing press. And so punctuation marks are not part of the translation process. They make it easier to read. And so how Oh, here's something else. What kinds of punctuation marks? True, the original King James did not have quotation marks. But the American Bible Society in the 1960s, I want to say 65, but I could be wrong, came out with probably the latest update to the King James Bible. And all they really did, if you read it, they update the punctuation marks. They put in the quotes, they put in the commas and the semicolons according to modern rules of grammar. That's all the update was that. And so splitting hairs over capitalized letters or punctuation marks, you know, if you're going to get that nitpicky into King James and how it's been corrupted, you need to go back to the original spelling, the original alphabet, knock yourself out. If you do that, then I will grant you the argument. But as long as you're using the modern Roman alphabet that's in there, which I think was finalized in the 1760 edition. It might have been 1665 edition, somewhere. I can't remember which century it was, but it was something like that. In fact, I think most people who read the King James really are reading the 1782 version that was authorized by the U.S. Congress, if you want to be honest with yourself. So don't hold too tight to that date, 1611, because you don't know. Or maybe you do know. You should know if you're going to be a King James only person. It is the gold standard. And it's a gold standard because of the level of peer review given to it and ordered so by the king. That is the gold standard. And honestly, with that said, that has been the gold standard for all modern translations of the Bible in the last century. From, I think, I'm going to say from the ASV, which was in 1901, which actually, before that, the ERV, English Revised Version, was commissioned by, I think, Oxford or Cambridge or somewhere in the UK, to have an updated English version that meant something to the modern reader. Because by the middle of the 1800s, the middle of the 1700s is considered the end of the Elizabethan era. And that's Elizabethan English is what the Bible, the King James, is written in. And so they wanted something that a more modern mindset could process. And the ASV was the American answer to that. And from there, honestly, is where, oh my gosh, there's this one update after another, after another. Now, some people will say, oh, it's just a copy of a copy of a copy. It's a copy of King James and a copy of what came next. That's not true. Every Bible translation has gone back to original languages. They may draw on how did the King James guy say it. They may draw on how did Tyndale put it, just like King James did. They may start with that, but I personally do that in my notes. I look at how the King James put it, and I look at how the Greek puts it, and I go, I would put it differently, you know, with my modern mindset of word choice. And there's a couple of spots where the King James translators could have put a little differently, a little bit closer meaning to what the Greek is saying. But I'm not saying that destroys the translation. It's a fine translation. But you can't, you know, disparage modern translations because it's just relying on KJV. The only one that does that, to my knowledge, is the NKJV. That's the only one who takes the original KJV and bases its work on that. I don't even think they consulted the original languages, because sometimes what they change is just strange. But every other translation, because I look into it. And the thing with the 50 translators, there are some that have 100 or more modern translators, and they all still do a peer review. So the same thing that makes the King James a hallmark gold standard, places like the NASB, I don't know to what degree the RSV does it, and I don't know how big the team is on the Holman Christian Standard Version or the CSB, HCSB and CSB. I don't know how big their teams are. I don't think they're 100, and I don't know how widely they peer review. Now, others, I think the I don't know about the ESV. From what I've compared, they're fairly accurate with the original Greek. But they all take this, the same thing that makes the KJV gold standard. They do too. The difference is no one today speaks Elizabethan English. I read an article about Shakespearean actors, and there's even dispute amongst Shakespearean actors how did Shakespeare's words actually sound in the 1600s. They don't know. They certainly didn't speak proper British English as is done today, and they certainly didn't speak, you know, the flat type of Middle Western or Appalachian English as some people think is how they spoke back then. They don't know. And honestly, some of the words' meanings have changed. For example, conversation and behavior, they sort of mean the same thing today, but they sort of don't. And there's other words that they use, like privy or privily. Well, you can kind of guess what that means, but we don't say privy much. And first, because of Mike, I say privy is the bathroom. And it doesn't fit if you apply that to the verse that you're reading. And so there's word updates. Which brings me to my final point that I want to make here. Is, again, from 1300s to 1600s, massive changes in English language went down. From 1600 to early 2000, there's been a lot of English language changes. There really has been. With the glories of the printing press and using a Roman typeface, in print, the words look the same, but the way that they're used, the way they're pronounced, slang terms come and go, old obscure words fade away. I was reading an article today from Webster's Dictionary website talking about sometimes words just disappear from the dictionary because they just don't get used. And in fact, a great deal of words from Elizabethan period are just gone. They're just not. You have to go find an old dictionary from 100 years ago to see some of these words. And this is why I think that it's important for modern translators to give us a new version or an updated version. Hey, base it on King James. Go for it. That'd be great. Use them as the hallmark. That's what I do whenever I really dig in and do like word for word. I mean, scratching and all the nitpicky stuff. I use King James, and I use the original Greek, and I arrive at my own decision on how did they come up with that, and is there a better word to use there that would fit a more modern mind. Now, I'm not saying I'm a good translator. I'm going to say I'm very poor at it. I just call it just my notes. It's my notes. It's for me personally. It's not intended at all for public consumption. But I'll share it sometimes. Oh, one final remark to the final remark. Here's a criticism amongst King James only people. Is that all the new translations, starting from the ASV of 1901, use a corrupted Greek text. And they introduce a lot of fallacies, and they introduce the idea that some verses should be taken out. All right. That is not entirely true, because the reason that challenge exists is that in the late 1800s, I want to say around 1890-ish, a scholarly work was put together to update the Textus Receptus, because by then a great deal of newly found original language manuscripts had been discovered that predate the ones in the Textus Receptus, which, as mentioned, largely come from the 1000 through the 1500s. That's where most of the Textus Receptus comes from. There's been a lot more work found that predates that. And sometimes people will complain, the last line of the Lord's Prayer, for thine is the kingdom and heaven, the power and the glory forever. That sometimes gets taken out of modern translations because older manuscripts do not have it. At some point, somebody inserted it. Now, the King James only crowd says, yeah, but those are Coptic or Alexandrian manuscripts. You can't trust them. They're just not reliable because so many places they conflict with Textus Receptus. Well, that could be true. But the thing about textual criticism is there are different families of manuscripts. For example, let's say a manuscript that a monk had in the year 800 AD became the basis for a whole ton of monks recopying. Well, at the same time, over in Greece, Alexandria, a monk may have had a copy that was in, 800 AD, that was based on something that came before, maybe the same copy that the Western monk had, and yet he didn't, those things didn't get perpetuated. And maybe in that family of manuscripts, maybe that verse doesn't show up. You know, maybe that the monk someplace inserted, maybe it was intended to be a marginal note, maybe something to expand on something. Doesn't make it bad. It just means that somebody somewhere inserted something and it became part of that family. And this family next door doesn't have that. But, you know, maybe they added something else somewhere. And so you have to consider these different families of manuscripts. Now, I say all that because in the 1890s, that's exactly what the scholarly work did, is it tried to take these discrepancies found in these other manuscripts and say, maybe some of what's in Textus Receptus shouldn't be there, because these guys at an earlier time period, they never said that. And you can say, oh yeah, but you just can't trust them, the Egyptians and what they wrote down, because Alexander, but I know it's not right. The early church father. he accepted all the ancient scripts he could find in his canon, and he figured he would let the bishop sort them out. Whereas the churches in Rome excluded a lot of things. So you say, oh, you can't distrust those guys. I'll just allow anything in there. Well, all I'm going to say is sometimes one family of things do vary, and you want to split the difference. Just like King James said to his translators, you want to shoot for middle of the road. You want to be conservative. If something wildly varies from, say, Alexandrian text to Byzantine text, don't consider it. Split the difference on it. You know, take what's been well accepted. And that's exactly what people who do, like the NASB and CSB translations, do. is they look at this newly compiled Greek work and see, oh yeah, well, this puts it really differently. Honestly, my copy of Greek that I work out of is it's basically Textus Receptus. It does have indicators. It does have indicators to point out how modern received texts differ as opposed to Alexandrian texts differ, as opposed to various things differ. And honestly, usually it's just a word spelling or a word order, like saying Christ Jesus as opposed to Jesus Christ. And that's it. I mean, the vast majority, that's how they're corrupted, air quotes, is that it's a spelling issue, it's a word order issue. Once in a while, there's a word that's not there, but it doesn't make any difference because it's kind of implied from the text that what that word is, and it doesn't make a difference if it's there or not. And so just go with how it's been done before. Just like King James relied on how it was done before with, you know, Tyndale and others. So I don't buy it if they say, oh, it's corrupted text. No, it's actually more robust, and it actually does prove how reliable Textus Receptus is, even though it points out some dubiousness, but it's not really, it doesn't destroy anything. It honestly, it does not. So anyway, that is actually my final thoughts on this. And if you stayed with it this long, hopefully it'll make sense. I in no way in trying to say that King James is not a gold standard. It is. I don't read from it. I do study from it. And so that's what I have on that. And I hope it helps. If you need defense of being a KJV only person, I hope that helped. I also hope it helped you understand why modern versions are equally based on really the same gold standard that KJV is. All they really try to do is modernize the Elizabethan language, and they modernize the punctuation marks, the grammar, and that's really the difference, if you ask me. And if you want to doubt it, you compare the modern ones to the King James ones, to the Bishop's Bible, to the Coverdale, and grab yourself a Greek or Hebrew text armed with a handy-dandy Strong's reference or other one, because honestly, that's a lifesaver for me, because there's times I can identify words, and there's times like, I don't know what that word is, I better look it up. So, anyway, I hope that's been helpful. I hope it's filled in some questions, maybe some curiosities about history and how we got from point A to point B. And I hope it helped defend your stance and understand the other stance, which is what Quest for Truth is all about. It's not only knowing why you believe something, but trying to understand what the other guy is saying too.
Can you answer the following questions for your children or for the person to whom you are witnessing? Number one, is the New Testament reliable? Two, can you explain the Trinity to me? Three, how is Jesus both God and man? And a slew of other questions you will be able to answer if you get Andrew Rappaport's new book, What Do We Believe? It will help you a ton. Get your copy at whatdowebelievebook.com, whatdowebelievebook.com.
The story is told of a man who had a dream. He was driving down a road and he saw a church building with demons swarming in and out the doors, on the roof, in and out the windows. He thought to himself, "Man, that must be an evil church to have so many demons." A little further down the road, he sees a church building with one solitary demon on the roof, sleeping. "Wow," he thought. "Only one sleeping demon. This church must be on fire for God." As he drove further down the road, he began to realize he made a mistake. The church with all those demons must have been on fire for God, for Satan had to work so hard. The church with one sleeping demon must have been a church where the devil had them right where he wanted them. Persecution will come for the Christian. We are promised it. When everything is going our way without any difficulty whatsoever, is that really a good thing? We may want to double check just in case. Countering the culture in our quest for truth, this is Nathan Caldwell for Countershock. Check out all our other Quest for Truth items over at life-truth.com.
Striving for Eternity is a Christ-centered ministry focused on equipping people for eternity, and they provide speakers and seminars that come to your church with expertise in theology, hermeneutics, world religions, creation science, evangelism, presuppositional apologetics, church history, and expertise in sexual abuse in the church. For details on their seminars and to request a speaker for your church, go to strivingforeternity.org. Striving to make today an eternal day for the glory of God.
Okay, and there we go. That is how we arrived at the King James and some of the reasons what makes it the gold standard. And honestly, it's the one thing is that peer review issue. It's not tradition. It's not language, you know, original language usage. It's not, it came first. It was not the first authorized. It's because there was so much effort, scholarly work, systematically poured into it to give us a translation that's meant to not rely on footnotes. But I will add a little bit in my epilogue here that I got thinking after I had put all this to recording, why did the Geneva Bible fall out of favor if it was so awesomely wonderful and great and everyone loved it? Well, for the same reason all the other ones did. And in a word, it is politics. If you notice, with the Great Bible, it came into favor because Henry VIII liked it. He didn't like the other ones. Well, and whenever the next, I think it was Queen Elizabeth came on the scene, she didn't like it. So she had the Bishop's Bible. And the other one kind of went away. And the same thing, whenever Geneva Bible came on the scene, the Bishop's Bible was still there, but it just kind of was eclipsed. And it fell out of favor. More by politics, you know, popular demand or lack of demand. And so whenever King James came on the scene, he, being the king, he wanted to push his version. So he literally made it illegal to even own or possess a Geneva Bible. And if you did, it was punishable upon death. He would put you to death for having one. You must have his King James Bible. And so that's how he kind of got the monopoly on that market. And you know, the funny thing is, one big reason why he wanted his own translation is he did not like the footnotes that were in the Geneva Bible. He felt that it led people to believe that only God had the supreme authority and gave authority to governments, and that it could lead to overthrowing a tyrant, that the people didn't like him. But guess what? After a few years of the King James being in circulation and outlawing Geneva Bible, they started putting the footnotes in the King James. And guess where they came from? They were direct carryovers. There was the exact same Geneva study notes and footnotes and references that King James did not like, and they started being put into the King James Bible. So yeah, he forced that version on everybody, but the reformers who were reformed, they still kept their footnotes. So anyway, a little bit of parting note there. So with that, I will wrap this up. Let me know what you think about this. There's still more to talk about. I'm sure I made some mistakes. They were unintentional, but they could be there. Let me know. I can clear some things up. I can study up on some more topic. So in a moment, we'll have Anthony Russo step in here, and he will tell you all the ways how you can contact us, largely through life-truth.com. It's fast becoming the center of how to find everything we do.
And you'll find we just redesigned the site a little bit, and there we put some sidebars and stuff back in there, so you can find what we do in other places on the web. So here we go. Take it away, Anthony Russo, and thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you next week.
Visit life-truth.com, where you can find all our shows. Leave a message or call our voicemail number at 401-753-4844. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/lifetruthpage. Follow us on Twitter at HNCAST. Everything Nathan Caldwell does can be found at facebook.com/protectorsofthebook. Music in the show is used by permission of Kevin Zerbe at zerbinator.wordpress.com. May the word of Christ dwell in you richly. May you find everything you need. And if you don't know Jesus, your greatest need is a Savior. Thanks for listening.